This episode is part of the Pool's Local Officials Stronger Together podcast series. It's one way we serve local officials through integrity, public service, fiscal responsibility, and operational excellence.
As always, please direct specific questions about coverage to your risk management advisor.
Welcome to episode 9G of the TML Risk Pool's Local Officials Stronger Together podcast. I'm your host, Scott Houston. Cyber attacks are one of cities and other local governments' biggest emerging exposures. That's why we're on episode 9G. We've actually done 7 cyber episodes thus far, and each of them is worth a listen. But so far, my favorites are this one and episode 9C. In 9C, you hear directly from a city manager in a city that was hacked and how difficult their recovery was. It's very eye-opening. But I like this one so much because it's so simple. Our cybersecurity team, which we affectionately call the Cyber Squad, has prepared a 15-minute cyber health check for local leaders. This is a little test that guides you through 5 questions that you, as an elected official or other leader, should take and get a handle on where your cyber efforts are. In this episode, Senior Cybersecurity Advisor Mike Bell and I will go through each of those 5 questions. The good news is that it's not a pass-fail type of test. It just helps you know where you are and, more importantly, what no-cost cyber services the Risk Pool has can move you down the road in your cybersecurity journey. So let's get right to it. Okay, we're now joined by Mike Bell, our Senior Cybersecurity Advisor. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Hey, I'm excited about this one. Tell me a little bit about why the Cyber Squad created this 15-minute cyber health check for our local leaders.
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. We created that cyber health check for our members because we noticed there was a gap, that there were a lot of our local leaders who are responsible for their cybersecurity oversight don't have a simple way to gauge their organization's readiness. You know, not everyone's an IT expert, and we wanted to meet our leaders where they're at. And so we created the short check to give them, you know, 5 high impact questions that could help them quickly assess whether their data systems might be exposed to things like ransomware or business email compromise or other gaps. You know, a recent article stated that 62% of all cyber attacks target public sector organizations. By my math, that's 3 out of 5. And this health check is really about giving leaders a quick read on their cyber risk posture so that they can make informed decisions and not just rely on assumptions.
Wow. And I think that's really good. And those statistics are really sobering. So we've put together a 1-page cyber health check test, if you will. And I've linked that below this podcast so folks can go take a look at it. Tell us how that test is scored and what it looks like.
Yeah, so the checkup, as you said, is 5 fundamental questions about your cybersecurity program, and each one is scored on a scale from 1 to 5. Leaders should just give their organization a rating, and the rating scale goes from 1 if there's no process in place. Give yourself a 2 if you have some activity, but it's ad hoc and rarely tested. Score a 3 if you have a formal policy or procedure, but it needs updating and improvement and or testing. And then a 4 if the function is well-developed and partially tested. And then finally, give yourself a 5 if it's fully implemented and regularly tested. But it's important to remember, this isn't about passing or failing. It's about getting a clear, honest picture of where you're at, so you know where to focus next.
I think it's awesome. I think the way that y'all have broken it down into these really basic parts is something that gives local leaders a chance to really start. And if they haven't done anything thus far, it gives them a way to think about how to move forward. So let's talk about those 5 specific questions that are in that cyber health checkup. So the first is, do we have a formal incident response plan and has it been tested in the past 12 months? I love the fact that when you've presented this at some of our regional meetings, people look at you and you say, if you don't know whether you have an incident response plan, you probably don't, right? Tell me more about this one.
Yeah, it's a good question. Having an incident response plan and actually testing it is one of the most important steps an organization can take. If a cyber attack were to occur tomorrow, your team shouldn't be figuring out on the fly what are the steps and who are the notifications and who are the partners we need to engage. You need to have a written plan that outlines who does what, who needs to be contacted, and how services are going to be restored. And as leaders, you should be a named participant in the IRP. So they should be, they should have heard of it. They should be very familiar with it, and they should also have a printed copy of it in a safe and accessible location. But just having that plan isn't enough. If they haven't tested it in the past year, then it's likely to have some outdated or unworkable components. And that's why we also offer tabletop exercises for our members so that they can realize those gaps before a real crisis hits. Scott, you mentioned co-presenting with me, and we have had this talk with many leaders so far. We had an example where recently a member who had a really good plan got hit with ransomware, but then they found out their plan had flaws. They had new computers they had procured, they had them in a closet. When they pulled them out to use them, they found out that those new computers didn't have the right network cards. They also had a plan to use paper checks when they couldn't get to their automated payment processing application. And then they learned, unfortunately, that those paper checks were never bought and put in the vault like they had planned. So you need to test your plan and pull it out and talk to your people and walk through it occasionally.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. A starting place, at least, if something happens. So next, the next question is, are we using multi-factor authentication for email, remote access, and privileged accounts? MFA is something that I've heard you say is so important that it can prevent almost 100% of the hacks that we see. Tell us more about MFA and why it's important.
Yeah, multi-factor authentication. Some people call it dual-factor authentication, but MFA is one of the simplest and most effective ways to stop cyber attacks, especially from phishing and remote access breaches. It works by requiring a second form of verification in addition to your username and password. And it's usually in the form of a code sent to your phone or a prompt by an application on your phone, something out of band to make a secondary authentication to ensure that's you and give you that opportunity to stop someone who may have had access to your legitimate credentials. For local governments, we recommend that they enforce MFA at a minimum for three areas: your email accounts, remote access into your organization, like through VPN, and any privileged or administrative accounts. And as you said, it was Microsoft who published the statistic this year that said that more than 99.9% of the compromised accounts that they've seen didn't have MFA enabled. And that's a huge percentage. So for our users that are only using a password, they need to realize that those credentials are many times compromised and that the attackers can often guess or steal those credentials. But with MFA, you get a second, it's kind of a deadbolt lock on the door that can stop that unauthorized access, even if the threat actors have gained access to your key. It's not a silver bullet, but 99.9% is pretty effective in my book.
For sure. That percentage is really sobering. And from my perspective, multi-factor authentication is probably the easiest thing to do. It's not something that requires a lot of work to get that set up. So the third thing is, are employees and officials trained to spot phishing and business email compromise threats? And do we test this regularly? Ryan Burns, who's the other half of the cyber squad at the TML Risk Pool, uses that term a lot, picnic, that the most common thing that happens is a problem with the person in chair, not in the computer. Employees and officials making mistakes and clicking on links or sharing passwords and other information is a big, big problem. So tell us about that question.
Right, Scott, just like you said, this one speaks to the human error side of cybersecurity. Phishing and business email compromise, what we call BEC, are the most common ways that attackers get access to your credentials. They trick us by sending realistic looking emails. They try to entice us into clicking a link, opening a fake attachment, document of some sort, somehow tricking us into entering our credentials when prompted. Now, we think it may be a legitimate reason. It looks businesslike. It may come from a familiar source, a vendor partner, or someone inside our own organization. That's why the training is critical. But you can't just train on this once a year and check the box. This needs to be ongoing and engaging and tested training. That's why at the risk pool, we recommend our members do regular training paired with simulated phishing tests so that they can see how their people will respond in a safe environment. And they can identify the people who are struggling to look for the signs of a phishing or an email compromise and give them the appropriate training ahead of time. If your staff or your elected officials don't know how to recognize a suspicious email, your organization is one click away from a serious breach, unfortunately.
So we talked about multi-factor authentication, and I said that's probably one of the easiest things that can be implemented to keep your computer system safe. But if I think about question number four, which is, do we verify wire transfers and vendor changes using out-of-band methods? That might actually be the easiest. We've had a number of local government officials wire substantial amounts of money after being tricked by cyber criminals over the past couple of years at the pool. And if they would have simply known to stop and contact that vendor or bank through an out-of-band method, that wouldn't have happened. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you're right. This one is not technical at all. This is a procedural type control. It's really about making sure the money doesn't go to the wrong place. Out of band just means verifying a request through a different channel other than the one that it came in on. So if someone sends you an email, says, hey, here's our new banking information, and that's a vendor, you don't just reply to that email or you don't call the phone number in the email. You pick up the phone and you call them at a known good number and verify that they're actually making this change to their banking and routing information. This is one of the top ways you stop fraudulent instruction scams. And as you said before, those have cost cities hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in one case, one of our members suffered a seven-figure loss. So it can really have catastrophic financial impacts to our members. And again, it's just a simple double check and making sure you've got the right processes in place to avoid being subjected to that type of scam.
And this is one of the ones where the psychology of the cyber criminal comes into play substantially, because typically in this case, they will make it seem like it's very urgent and typically appears though it's coming from somebody with authority over the person who's in charge of sending that transfer, right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they have access to our public documents. You know, most of our members publish, you know, contracts and agendas and decisions that the board has made or city council has made. And so the threat actors have all kinds of information, and they begin to assemble this information, and they know who we're doing business with, and they know about when payments should be made. And so they're really getting good at connecting those dots and inserting their fake emails in a timely manner.
Yeah, one of the things that blew me away about one of these fraudulent transfers we had is that, as it was explained to me, this city official had an email exchange with a longtime friend who was a vendor as well, and they had been having an email exchange about the project that was the subject of this payment. And the cyber criminals hacked into the email and were monitoring the conversation, and at the appropriate time took over the vendor's end of the conversation and said, oh, hey, can you change this? So it's not just a one-time phishing email that may come in that you have to recognize. Out-of-band authentication for any of these types of wire transfers or money transfers is always something that you should do, right?
Yeah, that's a great example of how it can happen, and the member organization is not aware that the partner's email has been compromised. It just looks like a legitimate continuation of that email exchange, as you mentioned.
Wow, pretty scary stuff. The final question in the cyber health checkup is a little bit more technical, and that is, do we have secure offline backups and can we restore them quickly? What's up with how that works?
Yeah, so this question really gets to the heart of your ransomware resilience. If your systems are locked up or encrypted, your backups are your safety net, but only if they're secure and offline. And that means they're stored in a way that an attacker who may have penetrated your network defenses can't reach them through your network. We've seen cases where backups were connected and got encrypted along with everything else. A recent study showed that for public sector organizations, threat actors attempt to compromise your backups 99% of the time, and that they were successful 51% of the time, over half. And when your backups get compromised, your recovery costs quadruple. And so That's one component of your backups. And then the other component is to make sure that you understand just how quickly you can restore from those good backups. It's one thing to have the backup, but it's another to know that how quickly you can bring your systems back online. And sometimes that may involve days or weeks. So the question isn't just about secure data storage. It's also about recovery processes.
Got it. An important step.
All right. That's it. We'll be right back with your action items.
Okay, welcome back. This is the time where we do our action items. But before we do that, I want to ask Mike a little bit about the size and sophistication of a TML risk pool member and how that affects what it is they should be doing. And I think, Mike, what you're going to tell me is that it really doesn't matter. The same fundamental principles are going to apply. Just some are going to be more complex depending on how many systems and computers and programs and all that you're using, right?
Yeah, you're 100% right, Scott. The threat actors, while they try to go after the larger entities, they're not discriminating much anymore. And fortunately for us, the same remedies that will help address cybersecurity risks for a large member will also apply to some of the smallest members we have, whether you're down to one employee, one laptop, or you have a very large infrastructure with your own IT department. These functions are still as effective, and they do scale. They may not all scale properly, but large organizations cover a large horizon. They have a large set of functions they provide their citizens, and smaller organizations still have to provide many of those same services, but with a smaller risk exposure because they may only have one office location with two employees. So back to your original point is, if you're a small organization with one laptop, you still want to make sure you encrypt that laptop, and you want to make sure you back up that data that's on that laptop in an offline fashion so that the threat actors can't get to those backups.
I just wanted to drive that point home that I just don't want a city official who has one laptop or two computers that they're doing all the city business on to think this stuff doesn't apply to them, that it only applies to, larger entities with complex IT systems. It's really important for any entity to follow these steps.
No, that's 100% correct. And that's why we try to serve all of our members where they're at right now. The TML membership is varied, as you just mentioned, but these cybersecurity services that we offer are available to all of them.
That's perfect. I just wanted to make that point very clear. So action items for today. Today, we're just going to do kind of one meandering action item, and that really is if a member isn't scoring well on one or any or all of these questions in the cyber health check, what can they do to improve? What services do you guys, the Cyber Squad, provide to them to get them in better shape?
Well, I appreciate you asking, because that's the best part of the health check is it's not a pass-fail test. It's an awareness starting point. If a member scores low, that just means there's room to improve, and we're here to help. As you identified, if they score well, though, I want to also be clear that this health check is an abbreviated form of a risk assessment, and we still advise that they take advantage of the risk pool services and ask us to conduct a full risk assessment, because there are many other areas that they need to be focusing on that are important to their cybersecurity programs. We offer a wide array of services. We at no cost to our members who have cybersecurity coverage to us, we'll sit down with you and go through your cybersecurity best practices. We can help you review your information security policies, and we can help you develop them if you have none. We have a template with a starter kit of 13 basic policies. We'll help you review your incident response plan. And if you don't have one, we'll send you a template to help you get started and work with you to get that completed. As I mentioned earlier, we'll do a risk assessment. We also conduct regional tabletop exercises, Scott. We did one in San Marcos a few months back, and next month we'll be down in the Rio Grande Valley conducting the next one. And we do those in conjunction with the federal government, with CISA, which is a division of the Department of Homeland Security. We also help our members with their disaster recovery planning. We also are known for our cybersecurity training offerings. We help people with that annual DIR required cybersecurity training. And we also can review any information security job descriptions you may have to make sure you're getting the right skills and experience you need to mitigate the threats your city's facing.
I think that the Cyber Squad is one of the best kept secrets that the TML Risk Pool has, and we want to be sure that it is no longer a secret. We really want to get this out there, this resource that's available at no cost to members. And everything you've talked about, is most of it is linked on our cyber liability page on our webpage, and I will link to that below the podcast. Mike, I can't thank you enough for what you do for our members and for being here today, and we'll talk again soon.
Appreciate it, Scott. Thank you.
To review written materials associated with the presentation or to ask Scott a question, please visit www.tmlirp.org and click on the Stronger Together podcast link. Please remember that the information in this episode is provided for informational purposes only and doesn't constitute legal advice. We recommend that you review the podcast and the accompanying written materials with your attorney prior to taking action.